Well, it's nice to see so many people out, and Randy said it's a brisk September evening, which makes me feel right at home. This is the way I like it. It's the climate I'm used to. So thank you for that as well. I think you must have been praying about the weather. Well, I knew that I had to give a different talk tonight, as most of the people here have heard all my other talks. And so this, I have been thinking about it for some time, and just letting the idea of what the subject had to be just be born, listening for inspiration and ideas. And on Sunday, this is Tuesday, on Sunday I got the idea. I was on a plane from Chicago to Dallas, and I was sitting beside a very nice man, and we got to talking to each other, asking each other what our business was, and I told him what I did, and he seemed to be very interested. The journey lasted for about 2.5 hours, and we got into pretty deep conversation. And he said to me, "I would like to share a story with you that I haven't told to many people, but I feel that you would understand it." And he said that 20 years ago, their little daughter, aged 12, was diagnosed as having cancer. And she was given 12 months to live. And he said, actually, she only lived 11 months. And he said what a hard time this was for him and his wife and the rest of the family to have to live through this. But he said that his little daughter had a CB radio, which meant that she could tune in to truck drivers and all different people. And this was her hobby, that she would talk to these people. And she told them a lot about herself. And some of these truck drivers rallied around and felt that they should do something for this little girl. So they called the local radio station. And they got a lot of interest and support going. And the radio station wanted to send her and her parents to Disneyland. But this man was telling me that they left it too late. By the time everything was organized, it was just 2 weeks before she passed away. And by this time, she was very weak. And they had taken her to L.A., but they decided that she wasn't strong enough to go all the way to Disneyland. So the radio station asked her, "Well, is there anything else that you would like to do, anything in the world?" And this little girl said, "I must see the Pacific Ocean." She didn't say, "I want to see it." She said, "I must see it." So they got a pilot, and the pilot said, "Well, you're going to see it. You're going to see it in style." So they took her up in this plane, and when the plane came down, just as they got out of L.A., and they were looking over the ocean, and he brought the plane way down low so that she could have a good view. And as they got down, two big whales just jumped up out of the sea like this, very gracefully. And the pilot couldn't believe it. He said he'd been 30 years in the air. He'd never seen that before. He'd seen one whale at a time, but he had never seen two together and them doing this. And the child was absolutely elated. She was overjoyed about this. And that night, this man and his wife were in their bedroom, and he said to her, "What do you think is the best thing that happened today? So many lovely things happened." And she said, "I think it was the whales." And he replied, "So did I." He said, "I felt when we saw the whales that the whales were saying they could take care of our little girl, and we cannot let go." The man was telling me a story, and I was crying, and he was crying. And he said that they both let go, and the child had such wonderful peace. And then he said, about a few days after the funeral took place, that he was feeling really sad and just hoping I brought this with me. he was feeling really sad, and he said that he was crying and feeling very depressed. And he went to his library and he took out a book and he decided to read the book, and the book was Moby Dick. And in the foreword of the book, we brought it, but I'll tell you in essence what it was. He said he opened this book, and it said on the foreword of the book that God made the great whales. And then it said that the two whales represented Michael and Gabriel, the two angels. And he felt that this is what these whales represented to him and to his wife. And said that after that the grief went whenever they felt that Michael and Gabriel, the angels, were taking care of his children. Now this set my thought to work. I had been working with a few patients recently with angels, with the idea of angels, angel messages and things that Mrs. Eddy said about angels. But I said to this man, well, I have a story now to tell to you. And I told him that just recently, about a month ago, I was invited to speak to some Sunday school children. And there were just me and the children in the room. There were no teachers and no parents. And so I asked them, they seemed a bit slow to get started. And I said, have you any questions that you would like to ask me? And one little girl put up her hand and she told me her name. And she said she was 8 years old. And she said, Mrs. Smith, I have a question to ask you. She said, why did my mommy die when I was only 5 and I needed her? Well, what a question to ask. I just felt that I wanted to run down there and take her up in my arms. And I was really praying for an answer. So I said to her, dear child, I don't know why he died. I really can't answer that question. But I do know that there is no death, and that your mommy hasn't died, that she hasn't gone any place. And I said, can you imagine what it must have been like for the disciples when they had followed this wonderful man, Jesus? They'd seen him healing all sorts of people, all sorts of diseases. He fed the multitude. He walked on the waves. He stilled the storm. He raised the dead. And then suddenly they came, they took him, they crucified him, they spat on him. I said, can you imagine how the disciples must have felt? They must have said, where is the God that this man told us about? Has he left him alone? Has he deserted him? And they must have thought, how can we go out and preach ever again when we saw this terrible thing happen to our master? But I said, do you know what happened? 3 days after that, our master rose from the dead. He rose to tell everybody in the world that there is no death. There really is no death. He overcame it for others. He finally overcame it for himself. And I said, now, can you imagine what that did for the disciples? When they saw that he overcame all that, all the hatred, all the opposition, all the suffering, he rose from the dead. And I said, that's the message for us, that nobody has ever died. And then I said, but I want to tell you another little story. Some years ago, there was a woman and her only little girl died when she was young. And this woman was absolutely grief-stricken. She couldn't get over this grief. She didn't want to mix with her friends. She sat in the house and cried. She wouldn't eat. She wouldn't go out. She drew her curtains. She sat in the dark. And then one night, she cried herself to sleep. And she had a dream. And in the dream, she saw all these little angels walking through heaven, all dressed up in white robes and carrying a candle, and they were singing. except for one little girl, and that was her little girl. And someone said to the little girl, "Why are you not singing, dear? And why is your candle out?" And she said, "My mommy's tears put my candle out, and I can't sing because my mommy is crying for me." And the woman woke up out of the dream and she said, "What have I been doing to my child?" She said, "I've been keeping her from enjoying heaven. So from today I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to draw back the curtains. I'm going to call all my friends. I'm going to have a party. I'm going to be happy. I'm going to rejoice." And she did that. And 3 weeks later, she had the same dream. And this time, her little girl was heading the procession. Her candle was lit, and she was singing. So I said to this little girl, "Do you want to put your mommy's candle out, dear?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, you better start rejoicing and stop grieving." And I said, "Does that answer your question?" And she said, "Can I come up there and answer it?" And I said, "Yes." And she came up, and I got four hugs. I was able to share this story with this man. Now, it made me think about angels. To me, this man was the angel message sent by God to tell me what my talk had to be about. And I felt that I was his angel messenger too, that I could bring some sort of comfort to him. And I want to read to you what Mary Baker Eddy says about angels. This is her definition of angels, because recently there's been quite a trend in bookstores and all sorts of places. You see little drawings of angels and books about angels. And sometimes it makes it look just as if they were little magic creatures. But Mrs. Eddy goes a step higher than that and tells us what angels really are. She says, "When angels visit us, we do not hear the rustle of wings, nor feel the feathery touch of the breast of a dove, but we know their presence by the love they create in our hearts. Oh, may you feel this touch. It is not the clasping of hands nor a loved person present. It is more than this. It is a spiritual idea that lights your path. The psalmist saith, 'He shall give his angels charge over thee.' God gives you his spiritual ideas, and in turn, they give you daily supplies. Never ask for tomorrow. It is enough that divine love is an ever-present help. And if you wait, never doubting, you will have all you need every moment. What a glorious inheritance is given to us through the understanding of omnipresent love. More we cannot ask. More we do not want. More we cannot have. This sweet assurance is the peace be still to all human fears, to suffering of every sort." The Bible has a lot to say about angels, and the writings of Mary Baker Eddy have a lot to say about angels. And I would suggest that you look up the concordance and find out for yourself what angels are. And then you will begin to see that these angels are infinite and omnipresent and omniactive right where you are. God has promised us legions of angels. And we must know that they are present and that they are meeting our needs. Now, this is a poem from the Christian Science Journal, which I loved. It was in 1981, September 1981's journal. And it's called "Let the Angels Tell Them." It says angels, God's thoughts passing to man, spiritual intuitions, pure and perfect, the inspiration of goodness, purity, and immortality, counteracting all evil, sensuality, and mortality. Isaiah of old said, "Hear now, behold, a virgin conceiving shall bear a son." Indeed, it would be as God's prophet foretold. But who would tell Mary, the favored one? Let Gabriel, let the angel tell Mary, the virgin of the highest will. But who would tell Joseph and make him believe that here was a virgin who could so conceive? The wise virgin Mary let an angel tell him. Let an angel tarry, for more surely we find does one believe angels than words from mankind. Who was there to go out at night time and tell the shepherds who wandered high up on a hill that the Savior was born? It was a bright angel who brought them good tidings of joy for all people. Practicing Christians, prepared to convey the Christ understanding that's with us today, proclaim the glad tidings, and should one refuse to hear healing truths from lips of men, let the angels tell them. Doesn't that tell you what angels do, the work that they do? And these angels are forever with us. About 4 or 5 years ago, I met a man at one of my talks who talked to me afterwards. He told me that his ancestors came from Ireland and he had always wanted to come to Ireland. And then I met him again at the beginning of this year at another talk. He said he still wanted to come to Ireland. And I said, "Well, what's keeping you?" And he said, "Well, I must confess to you that I have a terrible fear of flying." He said, "I love aeroplanes, but I simply can't fly." And so we kept in touch. I said to him, "Well, that fear can be met and overcome." And we kept in touch, and he told me once in a telephone conversation that some years ago his daughter had been at a boarding school and she called him and asked him to come and see her. And he bought an aeroplane ticket to go and see her, but he couldn't get on the plane. He just couldn't do it, and he went in his car and he had a puncture and all sorts of problems, and he drove so far and got tired and he felt discouraged. So I was encouraging him to come and to stand right up to this fear, and said to him that this fear could be overcome. And he asked if I would help him to overcome that fear, and I said I would. And we kept in touch for quite a while. And one of the things that I wrote to him and that we talked about were God's angels. And I told him to look up hymn number 9, which is, "All glory be to God Most High, and on the earth be peace. The angels sang in days of yore the song that ne'er shall cease till all the world knows peace." God's angels ever come and go, all winged with light and love. They bring us blessings from on high and lift our thoughts above. They whisper, "God is love." O longing hearts that wait on God through all the world so wide, He knows the angels that you need and sends them to your side to comfort, guard, and guide. Oh, wake and hear the angel's song that bids all discord cease. From pain and sorrow, doubt and fear, it brings us sweet release, and so our hearts find peace. So I worked with him to know that God's angels were omnipresent and on the active, and they were meeting his needs. I trusted these angels to tell him what he needed to know. Now we were in touch constantly by phone, and the time was drawing nearer for him to come to Ireland. He was going to meet me, first of all, in New York. And I would say to him, have you bought your tickets? And he would say, no, I'll buy them next week. And next week would come, I'd say, have you bought your tickets? No. And, you know, it came to a point where I was beginning to think that maybe I was trying to talk this man into something he just wasn't ready for. And I decided, well, I'm going to let the angels tell him and trust this to God's care. And then one day he called, very pleased with himself that he had finally bought the tickets. And so the time came for him to make this flight, and we went to meet him in New York, another friend and I. And he got off the plane looking so absolutely pleased with himself. And he told me that when he got on the plane, he was feeling quite nervous. He was sitting at the window, and then there was a vacant seat, and then a man on the other seat. And they began to talk to each other, and this man was a naval pilot, and he knew all about planes. And he took him step by step right through this whole journey. And it was interesting for me to see when he came off the plane, and he said, I want to introduce you to this man. And he said to me, this man was my angel. And we have been working with angel thoughts, and I thought it was so nice that he recognized that this man was the angel that he needed and met his every need. And he was able to meet some needs that this man had. He needed to know a lot of things about San Francisco, and he was able to help him with that. And anyway, we finally got to Ireland, and we were in Belfast one day, and he had to go one place and I had to go another. And then we met up with each other, and he had rented a car, and we went to get the car when he discovered that he had lost the keys. He couldn't remember where he left the keys. And I said to him, well, now, the accuser of our brethren is not here. We're not going to feel guilty about this or blame anybody, put any blame on anybody. We're going to trust that those angels that you saw were with you on the plane or with you wherever you are. So those angels are right here. And we walked right round the corner, and there was a taxi sitting there. And we got into the taxi, and I said to the driver, this man has lost his keys. And this taxi driver said, no problem, we'll find the keys. So we went to the place where he had been, and they weren't there. And as we drove along, this taxi driver was shouting to every other taxi driver, because my friend had come back in the taxi, and he described what the taxi driver was like. This taxi driver was shouting to every other taxi driver, if you see so-and-so, we're looking for keys. And we were driving round Belfast. This driver took us into places that I had never been. He took us into IRA areas that we always considered to be dangerous. And so my friend was getting a first-class view of Belfast and what it was like. And the whole thing was very interesting. And then we still hadn't found the keys. So he took us back to our house, and then we decided we wanted to go and have some fish and chips. And he said, well, I'll take you for the fish and chips. And then he went to find out about the keys. And while we were having them, he came back with the keys, waving the keys. He said, I've got the keys. And he became such a friend to us that in the end we asked him to take us out for a day and take us around all the places in Belfast where the IRA or the Protestant UDA or whatever hung out, and see all the murals on the walls and different things. And this man became such a friend to us, and he said to us, you are two angels. And he was our angel, you know, at the time. It just helped me to see how much these angels are just present with us everywhere, wherever we go. And so it made me think about things in my life, occasions in my life, when God's angels were there to help me. And before I start to tell you about them, I want to say there are some people here tonight from Oklahoma. Is that right? Well, put up your hand. Yeah. Put up your hand like you come from Oklahoma. That's it. Well, I want to say to you that during your recent problems, my thoughts and prayers were with the people of Oklahoma every day. Because I've been there, and I know what that situation is like. I was very pleased to hear how quickly the police here found the person who did it. Because in Ireland, we were not so fortunate to find people so quickly. And I think that that was a good demonstration and proof of all the prayerful work that I know you were doing, and certainly a lot of people throughout the world were doing. And when I heard that bomb, it reminded me of the day in Belfast when I was in the city centre and a bomb went off in a restaurant. And I was very close to this restaurant and everybody was running towards it. And I ran right up to the restaurant and the whole front of it had been blown out. Someone had brought in a bomb in a plastic carrier bag and they put it under a table and it went off and the mess in there was indescribable. And outside this restaurant there was a young soldier who looked to be about 17, like he'd just joined the army. He was fresh in there. He was standing outside and he was being sick. And I thought of my own son. I had a son at that age, at that time. So I went over and I put my arm around his shoulder and I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "They told me to go in there and clean up and I can't do it." And I said, "Well, I don't think anybody could ask you to do it when you're just not up to it." And I put my arm around him and I tried to comfort him and tell him that God was here with us. I said, one of our hymns said, "God is on the field, although he seems invisible." And I said, "Believe me, there'll be a lot of good come out of this experience." And just at that, an army officer came up and asked what the problem was, and I told him. And he was very kind. He went over to this boy and said, "It's okay, lad," he said. "You go in the ambulance with the rest of the people, and we won't ask you to go in there." Unfortunately, I had seen what was in there. And I had to walk home because all the buses were taken off. And I walked home. I cried all the way. I cried and cried and cried for the hurt, for the wounded, for the dead, for their families, for my country, thinking it was all so hopeless. And I got into my house, by which time I was in a state, my eyes were all swollen. And I thought, "Well, Myrtle, you're not doing anybody any good carrying on like this." So I washed my face, and when I was drying it in the mirror, I thought to myself that Mrs. Eddy said, "Man is the reflection of God's being." Now, I'm standing in front of a big mirror. If someone planted a bomb behind that wall, and the wall was blown up, and the mirror was broken into fragments, where would God's reflection be? Was God's reflection on the mirror? Was it behind the mirror? Where would you say God's reflection was? God's reflection was me. I am my own reflection. So if I turned around and I looked in 100 mirrors, I would see my reflection everywhere. Nothing had happened to my reflection. So nothing had happened to God's reflection. And I saw, okay, but material senses say these people have been blown to bits. But in truth, man is spiritual, whole, and perfect. Right now and always, you couldn't blow up a spiritual idea. You couldn't kill a spiritual idea. These people didn't go to God in bits. They were ever one with Him. And you know, when I saw that, I'd never seen reflection so clearly. But when I saw that, it gave me such a sense of assurance and peace and confidence that evil could never win. The Bible said, O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? It has no victory. It couldn't have a victory. Because God's child never went any place. God's child is right now at home in the bosom of God's dear love. And that's where those people in Oklahoma are. And that's where all their relatives and the people who grieve for them are. And God's legions of angels are right with all of them to deliver them from their distress. I was thinking about the time that angels helped me all through my life. And one of the worst problems that I had to meet was lack and limitation. My greatest problem was in finding supply to bring up 5 children alone. This was very, very difficult. And even before the breakup of my marriage, supply was very difficult. When my children began to grow up, we lived in a small 3-bedroomed house. And there wasn't much room for us to spread out. And my oldest son had to share a small bedroom with my youngest son. There were always rows. And I kept thinking how much we needed a bigger house. We needed to spread out. And I also at the same time was thinking that I would love to have a house that I could be a practitioner in, that I would have an office and I would have freedom to do that. I wasn't then in the practice. So I suggested to my husband that we look for a bigger house. But he kept saying we can't afford another house. We can only afford the mortgage that we have right now. We can't afford any other house. But I kept praying about it and thinking that in my Father's house are many mansions. And know that my maker was my husband and that he would make the decision. Well, one time a house came up. It was advertised in the paper. It was a big 5-bedroom house, a 3-story house. And the price seemed pretty good. And I asked my husband if we could go and look at it. So we did. Now, the people who lived in this house had also 5 children. And they were emigrating to Australia to get away from the situation in Northern Ireland. They had started at the top of their house to fix it, but they got no further than the top floor. So it needed an awful lot of work done to it. But I was thinking, well, you know, if I would say I would take this house, it's about the same price as the house that we are living in. My husband might agree to this, and we can gradually fix it up. I knew that it would take years because my husband was not good at doing things in the house, and we didn't have the money. But I was willing to go along with it, and he seemed willing to go along with it too. So we put an offer in on the house, and it was accepted. And on the day that we were going to actually sign for the house, I was still praying to know if this was the right thing, and that if it wasn't, God would show us. We called in to the house to have a final look at it, and my husband went to look at the electricity meter box when it fell off the wall with woodworm. So he immediately called in the surveyor, and the surveyor said, don't touch this house. It's riddled with woodworm from top to bottom. It has gone right into the house next door, and even if you replace all the wood in this house, all the floors and everything, it will eventually come back. So forget about it. So my husband seemed very pleased. about the outcome of this, and he said, okay, now will you forget about the house? We're not getting it. I tried. I was willing. Well, a week later, another house was advertised in the paper on the other side of the road from this house. But this house cost twice as much as this first one. But it had everything done to it. So I read it out to my husband, who said, forget it. Forget it. We're not even going to look at it. Don't even think about it. So I kept on thinking about it and asking him, please, couldn't we just go and look at it? And he said, well, okay, we'll go and look at it, but don't you even think about moving in, because you're not. And I said, well, I would like to see what you can do to an old house like that. This house has it all done. Well, we went to see this house. The real estate agent showed us around, and I couldn't believe this house. It had everything done, a beautiful new kitchen, new bathroom, all replastered, replumbing, new roof. Everything was beautifully furnished, decorated, all beautiful carpets, velvet curtains. And I'm going, oh, wasn't that lovely? And my husband's going, shut up. This guy will think we're interested. So when we came to the end of the little tour, this agent said, could I have your telephone number? And my husband said, no. And I said, hold out your hand. He held out his hand, and I wrote the telephone number on his hand. Well, I went on praying about the house. And I thought, you know, God doesn't dangle something lovely in front of your eyes and say, there's no way you're going to get it, you can't have it. He doesn't do that. Now, I began to see that the problem here was my concept of God. That I was saying, okay, I'll settle for that house, that'll do, and we'll fix it up, and we'll do this, and we'll do that. But the other house was saying, oh, this is the way I do it. This is the way my father does it. He does it in style. He gives you the best. The house is done. It's fixed. It's beautiful. Get your concept of God right, Merle. And I knew that that was an angel message talking to me. So I said, right, I'm going to get my concept of God right. And I started to hold to the truth. Well, one day the agent called me and he said, well, have you thought any more about that house? And I said, I haven't stopped thinking about it. He said, well, why don't you put in an offer? And I said, I couldn't, because the offer that we would put in would be ridiculous. It's half the amount that you are asking for the house. He said, well, Mrs. Smith, I'm going to be honest with you. The young couple who live in that house are Roman Catholics. They bought that house at the beginning of the Troubles. This is a Protestant locality. This young couple, their family were builders. They bought that house in a bad state. They fixed it all up. And now they can't live in it. They haven't lived in it for a year. They've spent so much money on advertising, and you are the only people who even came to look at it. So put your bid in. So my husband wasn't home, and I said, all right, I'll tell you the bid. I put the bid in, and my husband came home from work, and I said, I better confess what I have done. And first he was a bit angry, and then he laughed and he said, well, there's no chance. They'll never drop it that much. They'll never accept that price. Well, an hour later, this estate agent called up. He said, this couple have accepted your offer. So my husband said, there must be something wrong with that house. So he sent the same surveyor to look at this house, and this surveyor said, go for it. He said, if you don't want this house, I'm going to buy it. I haven't seen such a good bargain in years. So we said, all right, we will let this offer stand, providing we can sell our house. We put our house in with a different estate agent. You call them estate agents? Real estate agent. We put our house in with a different one. And it went on the market on a Wednesday. And on the Wednesday night, I went to church, and I had to get two buses to church and two buses home. And I came home, it was late, and my husband opened the door, and he said, "There are a young couple here who want to live at the house." Well, I couldn't believe it, that someone had come so quick and so late at night, and all my kids were in bed, and the house wasn't very tidy. And anyway, I let them see the house, and they absolutely loved it. And they said to me, would you be prepared to sell your carpets and your curtains, because we like it as it is, and all the light fittings?" And I said, well, we might have to, because they wouldn't fit in the house that we are going to. And one of the objections that my husband had to the house was that even if we bought it, we couldn't afford to carpet it and curtain it and put more furniture into it. Anyway, the next morning, the real estate agent from the house that we wanted to buy called me and said, "Congratulations, your house is sold." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? You're not the real estate agent for this house." He said, "No, but the couple who came out to your house last night are the couple whose house you're going to buy." And they want to know, can they come and see you? They came to see us and they asked, "Will you swap carpets and curtains and everything, light fittings?" And we said we would be delighted. And we left some gardening tools and they left other things. And this was the most wonderful, just a very neat, orderly exchange. This whole house had just been redecorated. And so we moved into it. But I began to worry about the other people. I thought, this doesn't seem right, that they have lost out on this deal. And so I began to pray to know that God's law of compensation was present and in operation in their experience, that they couldn't lose out. Well, the wife, she called me up one day. She said, "I want to tell you how much we love your house, and it was so clean and nice and everything." And we got into conversation, and she told me that she would love to have a baby. And they had tried for 5 years, and they hadn't had any success. And I talked to her about God and being the only creator and so forth. And then one day she called, and she asked if I would pray for her, so that she could have a child. And I talked to her about Hannah and Samuel, and that God said of the solitary and families, and we kept in touch with each other. And then one day she called to tell me the good news that she was going to have a baby. And so we kept in touch. And when they were in this, she had a beautiful little boy, when they were in the house 3 years, they decided to move house. Now the house that they had bought from us was in a good area, because lots of Catholic people who were nervous where they lived were buying houses in this area. And when they sold their house, they made over double the price. And so they got back everything that was put into that house. Wasn't that a lovely proof of God's care? And the angel messages that I was getting all through that time. It was nice that I, you know, when my husband said, "There's no way, you're not going to do it, you can't get it," these angel messages would say to me, "Thy maker is thy husband." And he's not saying, "No way." He didn't show you this lovely home and then say, "The one across the road is going to have to do you." That's not the way God does things. The nice thing about it was also that the house that we finally bought was on the sunny side of the street, and the other house hardly ever got any sun. So that was another time that God's angels were taking care of me. Another situation was when I applied for class instruction. I had read a lecture in the Christian Science Monitor, and I thought I would love that man to be my teacher. But I looked up where he lived, and it was New York. Now, New York to me then was like the moon. You might as well ask me to go to the moon as go to New York. It seemed so absolutely impossible. But I kept reading this lecture. And then one day I asked a member of my church, have you read this lecture? And she said, oh yes, he's our next lecturer. He's coming here next month. Well, I couldn't wait for this come. His lecture was on Thursday and he came to church on Wednesday. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, you know, I read your lecture in the monitor, and when I read it, I thought I would love that man to be my teacher. So he said, well, what's stopping you? That was May, and his class was in August. The same week, four of my children were accepted as pupils at a school for Christian Scientists in England. I was told that they would all need three sets of sheets each, bedclothes, six sets of towels, dressing gowns, pajamas, their uniforms, their everything. Oh my goodness, it just seemed absolutely impossible for us to even meet that, never mind think about me trying to go to New York. But boy, I was praying about it, I was really praying, and my teacher was sending me some really encouraging letters. So I just kept my mind open to the truth. And a practitioner in London had said to me once, open your thought, dear, and your old body will just have to follow. So I thought, well, I'd better open my thought about this. But the week before I was to fly, I had provisionally booked a ticket. And the week before I was to fly, there was no sign of any money coming for this trip. And the pressures for school and all the things that my children needed were just getting greater and greater. And so I said to my husband, you know, I think that I better not go this year. I think that I'll send my teacher a telegram and say I'll think about it next year, but not this year. It just seemed to be too much. But my husband had planned a camping holiday for him and the children in England, and he very much wanted to go to that. And he was going to take them there so that people wouldn't know that I was away for class. So he said to me, well, there must be something that we could do. And he remembered that he had an insurance policy. And he said, well, I'll take it down to the office and see if I can cash it in. And he came back and he told me that the man said, I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, but this needs to go to our London office and it takes about 6 weeks. And my husband said, well, we don't have 6 weeks. She's going in a week. And the man said, I'm sorry, it's not in my hands. And my husband said this most surprising thing to me, because he was anti-Christian Science. And he said to me, well, I just said to myself, mister, it was never in your hands. And he came home and he told me this, and just at that the telephone rang, and it was this insurance company. They said, we rang the head office and you can have the money tomorrow. And I got the money for the ticket. There was just the money for the ticket. There was $100 per class, and there was $100 left for me. And I had nowhere to stay. And $100, as you know, is not a lot of money. So my husband said, you mean you're going to go to New York and you don't know where you're going to stay and you've only got $100? I said, I believe that God takes us all the way. So yes, I'm going. I'm getting on that plane. So I went and I got on the plane, and as soon as I was up there, I just knew God was taking care of everything. I got off the plane and there was an announcement, would I please go to the desk in New York. This man met me. He said, my teacher told me to come and meet you. He said, I have to take you to this apartment where you're going to stay, and he told me I have to stop off and buy you some groceries. This man paid the taxi. He went to the grocery store with me and we filled up a big trolley. He said, the lady that you're staying with is on holiday and she won't be here for a few days. He insisted on paying for all the groceries. I got to this most gorgeous apartment. I was sinking in pink rugs and antique lamps, and I just couldn't believe it. It was right in the middle of Manhattan, and the view, and I just got through the door, my eyes were everywhere, and the telephone went. It was my teacher, and he said, "I'm sorry, that's the best I could do." And then he said, "You know, you must have been really praying." He said, "I'm going to tell you something. The woman who owns this apartment is a friend of mine. And for years, she has helped me to find places for my students. But she always said to me, 'Bill, never ask me to put anybody up. I don't like people staying in my apartment.'" So he had asked her about me, and she tried all her friends, and they were either away or having visitors or whatever. He said, "We couldn't find a place for you, and you were in the air. And my wife said to me, 'What about that Irish woman?' He said, 'I don't know. She's in the air, and I don't know where she's going to go, and I don't think she's got much money.'" And he said, the telephone rang, and it was this woman, whose name was Ruth. She said, "I've just been thinking about the Irish woman. Did you find a place for her?" And he said, "No." And she said, "Well, Bill, she can stay in my apartment. I'm going to break my own rule because I want to do something for the Irish." She said, "They're having such a hard time." And she was on holiday in Long Island. And this was Friday that I arrived. And she said she would come on Sunday. So I stayed in this apartment. All their friends, one called me up for breakfast. "Would you have breakfast at 6 a.m.? I couldn't, 6 a.m., nobody does that in Ireland. 6 a.m. breakfast, somebody took me for lunch, somebody took me for dinner. And when this woman came, we just fell in love with each other. We just loved each other. She got up every morning, she made me my breakfast, and I would go off to class. In class, everybody fought over who would buy me lunch every day. You bought it the day before and you bought it. They bought me taxis. They spoiled me. I couldn't spend money. I still have my $100 in my purse, and I just couldn't spend money. And in the afternoon, we would go to the reading room, and I would come back, and she would say to me, "Right, go in there and do your homework. Come out at 6, and we watch the news, and we'll talk, and then you can get back to your homework." And I did that every day for those 2 weeks. She and I would talk for about an hour and have fun and talk about Ireland and all sorts of things, and then I would get back to my homework. And this went on for the whole 2 weeks. And I had told her about my friends, that my children had been accepted for Claremont School and all the things that they needed and so forth. At the end of 2 weeks, my teacher said to me, "Well, you've come this far. There's another week on your ticket. You'll have to go to Boston." He said, "I have a friend there who will put you up, and she will meet you." So I went to Boston. The man who met me at the airport bought me a train ticket to go there, first class train ticket. This girl met me in Boston. She said, "The girl in the apartment next door to me is on holiday. She said you can use her apartment." And this young woman brought me every day into the mother church. She took me to see all Mrs. Eddy's houses. She gave me dinner every night. People at the mother church were buying me lunch. I still had my $100. And when I came back to New York, my friend had a party for me, a shower, you call it. She told all her friends, and they all came with sheets, pillowcases, pajamas, dressing gowns. I had to borrow 2 suitcases to go home. And I went home with $98. Now, that was some angel that I traveled with, wasn't it? This angel thought that my teacher recognized and put his foot on immediately. He said, "If you get a message like that, that's an angel message. That is the Christ speaking to you, and you should act upon it." And I acted upon it. And look at the barriers that broke down for me. The impossibility of ever coming to America. I thought that was impossible to me. When I came to New York, it seemed to me like a big concrete jungle. And I was terrified of it. All the sirens and the big tall buildings. You felt like a little ant. But I stayed in such a lovely place and met such lovely people that I saw it was like broken up into villages. And I began to be able to accept that. And you know, I was in Boston 3 times in 2 years and everything was paid for. These are the angels that were at work in my life. So many of them, I could write books about it, volumes. There just isn't enough time to tell you them all. Another time when my angels helped me was when my eldest son had to go and live in London. He worked for a very famous men's outfitters in Britain. He worked in their store in Belfast. He decided that he wanted to quit school, although he was doing very well at it, and that he wanted to earn money. And this shop was bombed 3 times, and in the end they closed it, and they asked David if he would like to go to London to their store in Regent Street. And he wanted to do that because he wanted to see London, but because he'd had many beatings from my husband as well as me, and he needed to get out of the house. So at 17 and a half, he went to live in London, and that was a hard thing for me to let him go, but I felt it was better for him. He didn't earn a lot of money, and I couldn't help him financially. I didn't have any money. And when I would question him about where was he staying and how was he coping, he would say, "I'm all right, Mom, really, I'm all right. Don't you worry about me." But one Sunday he called me and he was crying. And he said, "Mom, I didn't tell you, but this house I live in is horrible. It's dirty and there are so many people live in it and I've only got a little room. And it's so miserable that I'm out walking the streets today. And I haven't any money and I haven't eaten. And I don't know what to do." Well, I was crying and I said, "Oh dear, just come home. Just come home, son. I will find a fare somewhere to bring you home." And he said, "Mom, you know that that's not the answer. That's not the answer either. Just pray for me, Mom." So I said, "Okay." And I went off the phone and I was crying. And then I asked God for some angel messages. And the angel message came was that this was not my son, this was God's son. And that God loved him wherever he was. There was not more good in my home in Belfast than there was right where he was. These lovely angel thoughts kept flowing, that all of God's goodness and his superabundance was there and would meet his every need, whatever his need was for. Because he said he was lonely, hadn't made many friends. And whatever his need was for, whether it was for companionship or money or a place to live, whatever it was, those legions of angels were with him. And I went over the 91st Psalm, "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." And I knew that's where he was dwelling. He wasn't a mortal dwelling in a horrible place or in a strange city. He was dwelling in the secret place of the Most High, which was the kingdom of heaven. He was right there, and I could put him there and know that these legions of angels were taking care of him just right where he was. That evening, he called me back. He said, "Mom, you'll never believe what happened. I came out of that telephone kiosk. I saw a little shop. It had notices in the window. And I read one, and it said that a young man wanted another young man to share a house with him. I got the address. I went round to this house. It's a really nice house. It's on the River Thames. This young man was an engineer. And he and David seemed to get on very well together. And they talked about the duties in the house, what they should do. And David liked cooking, the other young man didn't. He said he would do the housework, and he told David he could move in that night or the next day. And David moved in the next day. And he told me there was a tennis club just three doors away. He was able to join his tennis club. He made many, many new friends. And as a housewarming party, I gave him a gift subscription to the Monitor. And he told me on the day that it arrived, he called me up to thank me. And he said when it fell through the letterbox, and this young man that he shared the house with picked it up, and he said, "Is that the Christian Science Monitor?" And David said, "Yes." He said, "Well, how did you get that?" And David said, "Well, all my family are Christian Scientists." And this young man said, "I can't believe this." He said, "The girl I am engaged to is a Christian Scientist, and I have started going to her church." And this whole thing worked out so perfectly. He lived there quite a while with this young man until they both married. That was another proof to me that God's angels are always in control, but we have to know it. And you know, we have to know that that's true in our church as well. So many of us are concerned about the things that have been happening in our church and in our movement. But if we become concerned, we're not trusting God's angel. If you think about the angel and what Mrs. Eddy says angels are, then we have to know that he that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High, that is our church. Church is a spiritual idea, a divine idea. We have to know that our church is in the secret place of the Most High, and so is every member without exception. We have to put every member into this secret place of the Most High. When we do that, we'll stop being frightened. We stop being upset. We stop being angry. And we will see the way to solve our problems when we're calm and at peace, not when we're angry. That doesn't solve anything. You know this poem that I just read to you? I'll read it to you again because I want you to think about letting the angels tell them. Angels, God's thoughts passing to man, spiritual intuitions, pure and perfect. The inspiration of goodness, purity, and immortality, counteracting all evil, sensuality, and mortality. Isaiah of old said, "Hear now, behold, a virgin conceiving shall bear a son." Indeed, it would be as God's prophet foretold. But who would tell Mary, the favored one? Let Gabriel, let the angel tell Mary, the virgin of the highest will. But who would tell Joseph and make him believe that here was a virgin who could so conceive? The wise virgin Mary, let an angel tell him. Let an angel tarry, or more surely we find, does one believe angels than words from mankind? Who was there to go out at night time and tell the shepherds who wandered high up on the hill that the Savior was born? It was a bright angel who brought them good tidings of joy for all people. Practicing Christians prepared to convey the Christ, understanding that's with us today, proclaim the glad tidings. And should one refuse to hear healing truths from lips of men, let the angels tell them. Can we trust those angels to tell every member what they need to know? We have to do it. We have to do it for the cause of Christian Science. Mrs. Eddy said about the Mother Church, "This building begun will go up, and no one can suffer from it, for no one can resist the power that is behind it. And against this church temple, the gates of hell shall not prevail." Our leader said those words. She meant them, and she knew what she was talking about. As I've said in other talks, our church is us. C-H-U-R-C-H. You are church in action. And what we have to concentrate on is better healing. Better healing. We have to look for opportunities to heal. How many non-scientists have you healed this week? Put up your hand if you healed one. How about this month? Ah, there's a hand up. That's encouraging. A hand up. Out of all these people, one hand up. How many of you healed this year? Good. You see, this is what we have to be doing. You might say, "I don't know anybody to heal." Tell me this. Do you know anybody that doesn't need healed of something? Healed of fear? Fear of flying? Fear of anything? Fear of poverty? Fear of disease? Fear of old age? Fear of death? Do you know anybody that doesn't need that? Forget about trying to get the people to come to our church and be Christian Scientists. Forget about it. Just say, "This is a person in need, and I know something that's going to meet their need, and I know how to meet that need." Now, I meet these people all the time. I meet them in airplanes, I meet them everywhere, and I don't try to tell them I'm a Christian Scientist and you should take up the study and it'll do wonders for you. I just tell them that God loves them and God is meeting their need right where they are. I took part in a seminar in Paris in July, and on the last day there were seven of us on a panel, four ex-lecturers and a Christian Science teacher from Paris, and two other practitioners from France. And we were asking questions, or being asked questions, and one of the questions was, "Do you only heal Christian Scientists? And if not, how do you let people know that you're available for this healing work?" And two of the lecturers said that they advertised in Yellow Pages. And then this little practitioner from the south of France, she said, "Oh, I don't know any Christian Scientists to heal. I can only heal Roman Catholics." She said, "Because I live in a village in France and all my friends and neighbors are Roman Catholics, and I can only heal them." And everybody was looking at her in amazement, and they said, "Well, how do you go about it?" She said, "Well, for instance, last week I had a telephone call from a woman, and this woman said, 'Is my daughter in your house?' And she said, 'No, I don't think so. I don't know your daughter.' And this woman said, 'Oh, I've made a mistake. I have dialed the wrong number.' She said, 'I have just put my back out and I can't straighten up and I'm in agony.' She said, 'I don't know what to do. I was to go shopping and my daughter will have to come home and help me and she'd have to shop.' And she said, 'I'm very sorry to have troubled you. I've called the wrong number.' And this woman said, 'Oh, my dear, you called the right number.' She said, 'I will heal you and you will go shopping at 10 o'clock. And the woman said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she told her, "I am a Christian Science practitioner and I will pray for you. Would you like me to pray for you? She said, I do healing work. And the woman said, I would love you to pray for me. And the woman called her at 10:05. She was healed. And she went and did her shopping. And then this woman told us about her husband, who was a practitioner. He had recently passed on, but he'd been a very successful practitioner in this village in France for many, many years, though his name was never in the journal, because someone had written to Boston and told them not to put this man's name in the journal. The things that they said about him were not true, but he decided he didn't need the Christian Science Journal. He said Jesus was never in the journal, and it didn't stop him from healing. And he went to live in this little village, and he helped to heal farmers and their animals, their cows when they were having calves. He was paid with potatoes and vegetables. And when he married this woman, one day she went with him to see a patient. And he said to the patient, I'm sorry, I have many other patients that I have to go and see. I don't have much time, but if you like, my wife will wait until I come back. So his wife thought that he had been very abrupt with this woman, and she said to the woman, I'll read to you. And she got the journal she was reading to her, and the husband came back, and they got into the car, and the husband said, well, now you've started that case, just finish it. And she said, oh, I'm not trying to take over your practice, I was only reading to the woman. He said, I need an assistant, and it's time that you learn to heal. And she took up the case and she healed the woman, and she's been in the practice ever since. And do you know that that is the fastest growing Christian Science church in southern France? And that's what we should all be doing, looking for opportunities. Mortal mind says, I don't know how to heal. You don't know how to heal, and you read the lesson sermon every day. Our lesson sermon would heal anything. In my early days of the practice, I would go through the lesson sermon with each patient in mind. I would do it maybe 7 times or 10 times with each person in mind, and knew that the answers were there from our impersonal pastor. Before we stop, I want to tell you a wonderful healing I heard about last year. I was in Canada, and I spent some time with this man who originally came from Northern Ireland. And someone in my association had told me that this man had helped someone with a mental problem, and she had had a wonderful healing. So I asked him if he would tell me the story. He told me that one day he had a phone call from a young man who said, you don't know me. He said, but my wife is in a mental institution. She's been put in there, and they said that she can never be released. He said, we have 2 young children, and my wife is like an animal in a cage. And for 3 months, the only words that she has spoken were your name. And he said, we didn't know who you were. We never heard your name. Nobody knew it. We asked all her friends. Nobody knew this name, but she kept repeating this name over and over and over. And he said, yesterday, I was in town and I met my wife's school friend that they used to go around together when they were young. And he told her the story. And she said, I know that name. She said, when your wife and I were teenagers, we went to a party. And this young man was there with his brother, and they were the only 2 young men who were not drinking at the party. And she said, we teased them and asked them why they didn't drink. And they said, because they were Christian Scientists. And she said, I remember your wife asking him, well, what is a Christian Scientist and what do they believe? And she wouldn't let him alone. So he said, I went to your church and I found out your telephone number and I'm calling you, and I wonder if you would come and visit my wife. So he said that he would. He said he remembered the party. He said, I don't remember much of the conversation, but I'd certainly go if you think that it would help. So we went along to this hospital, and this woman was in a room, and he said she was like a caged animal. She'd taken off her clothes, and she was just sitting with her arms up like this, and she was so thin and frail. And he went up and he tried to talk to her, but he got no response. And finally, he was about to come away, and then he said to her, do you know who I am? And he told her his name. And immediately, her eyes gave some recognition. And he said to her, do you want me to go on talking? And she nodded her head. So he kept on talking. He told her that God loved her, and that God was with her everywhere, and that God's angels were with her, and these angel messages were thoughts, and these angels could deliver her. And then he said to her, do you want me to come back and visit you next week? And she said, yes. And the doctor was very pleased, because that was the only sign of response that they got. So he started to visit her every week. And she started gradually to respond, until she was actually having a conversation with him. But she wouldn't speak to the doctor, she wouldn't speak to her husband or anybody. Anyway, after some months of this, the doctor came to this man one day and he said, we would like to try her outside for a weekend to see what happens. But she can't go home to her husband or children. Would you be prepared to take her home? Well, he said, I would have to ask my wife, because we have 5 children. And he asked his wife, and his wife said, yes, I think we must. We must take her home. So they took her home, and the doctor gave him lots of medication. He said, you must give that to her or she will become violent. But he decided they were not going to give her medication. He said when they got her home, she was nervous and strange and crying, and he had a rocking chair, and he took her on his lap. He said she was so tiny and frail. He took her on his lap, and his wife got a patchwork quilt, and she put it round her. And he rocked her in the chair in his arms, and he just told her that God loved her, that she was so dear to God's heart, that she was the loved of love, and that God's love could penetrate anything. It could overcome any fear, that she could never, ever be out of his care, not even for a second. She was the loved of love, and they would sing to her all these hymns. And she went back that weekend. She hadn't taken any medicine. She was much better. So a great improvement in her. He took her home a few more weekends. He kept on visiting her. And finally she was healed. But then she wasn't allowed out, because she'd been signed in. And she was supposed to be there for life. And their law said she couldn't get out of there. And he said to her, those angels are still with us, and they will give us the ideas that we need. And then it came to him one day, he remembered the nursing facility, 10 Acre, in New Jersey, which was America. That if he could get, and they had a hall there for mental patients, if he could get her in there, she would be out of Canada, she'd be under American laws, and they could free her. So she got into 10 Acre and she stayed there for 6 weeks. She walked out free. She's now a member of the church and has 3 children. Wasn't that a wonderful story? This man also told me, he's an engineer and he's built big bridges, he and his brother. He told me that one time they were working with, I think it was a Spanish or Italian family, and they were doing work in their the place where they lived. And he said this family were very noisy and very excitable and used their hands a lot, spoke in their language. And the first morning he went there, they asked him to join them for breakfast. And he noticed that the mother had lost all her hair. And so they were telling him very excitedly that she has cancer and she's had all this treatment. She's getting worse and there's no hope for her. He was telling all these stories. So he was being very polite and trying not to say too much. But every morning he had to have breakfast with them. And they were always talking about the mother, and they would cry, and they were all upset. And he said after about the fifth morning, he couldn't take it anymore. And he said they were all excited and shouting, and the mother was crying. And he said, "Stop, stop, stop." And they all looked at him, and he said, "Look, I can't take this. I'm a Christian Scientist, and I can't be taken in by this picture. I'm not going to be hypnotized. That woman is the child of God, and God never put this sentence on her. And because he didn't put this sentence on her, it's not legitimate. It can't stand. It can't hold." All these men were looking at him like he was quite mad. And he said he couldn't stop. But the mother was looking at him. And she said, "You, come here." And he went over and sat beside her. She said, "You talk to me some more." So he talked to her. So the next morning he came in. She said, "You come sit." He said, "Look, I have to get out and do my work." "No," she said, "I want you to sit with me." And he sat and he talked with her every morning. He told her about the lesson sermon. He began to read the lesson sermon to her. The other family all began to listen. And every morning this was their little ritual. Every morning. When the woman went back to the hospital, they couldn't find a trace of her cancer. She was completely healed, and her hair grew back again. You see, there's wonderful healing work going on. Sometimes we look at people in our church and we say, "Oh, look at so-and-so, and they're not doing very well, and they haven't got healed." And we become discouraged. Well, that's not the way to help anybody. You have to go home and say to yourself, "Not in my church. My church home is my consciousness. I refuse to see that about the members of my church or about anybody." Because remember, if you believe it for them, you can believe it for yourself. And in one of my talks, I asked you to pray for practitioners and teachers and lecturers every day to know that their work could be effective. And you've really got to do that. To know that with God, all things are possible. Do we believe that just some things are possible in Christian Science, but some things are not? You're not saying that about Christian Science. You're saying it about God. Did our Master believe that anything was impossible to God? He healed every known disease. He walked on the waves. He overcame the laws of gravity. He stilled the storms. He raised the dead. And he raised himself from the dead. And just go back and make yourself read all the testimonies in A Century of Christian Science Healing in the back of our textbook. Remind yourselves of the things that have been healed in our movement. And to know that the power is God's. The power that fills the garment's hem is evermore the same. Evermore the same. It hasn't lost its power. And we can't be made to lose our ability to accept and believe that truth. All we need is more faith, more confidence in the truth, not in ourselves, but in God. And to know that he's a loving God and that he loves us each and every one with a love that's indescribable. We've only to accept that and believe it. He loves each and every one of you so much. I'm going to finish by reading this hymn again. Think about these angels and just think about the power of the word. All glory be to God Most High, and on the earth be peace. The angels sang in days of yore, O longing hearts that wait on God through all the world so wide, he knows the angels that you need and sends them to your side to comfort guard and guide. Oh, wake and hear the angel's song that bids all discord cease from pain and sorrow, doubt and fear. It brings us sweet release, and so our hearts find peace. Is there anything I haven't covered that you would like me to? Well, this lady has asked me to tell you a story about, I don't know, do you remember the time that lecturers were asked to give a lecture on peace for a month, right throughout the whole world? Well, our church was going to have one of these lectures, and to support the board of lectureship, I wasn't a lecturer then, I decided to try and get a better understanding of peace for myself. And so I began to look up all the things it says in the Bible and the writings of Mrs. Eddy about peace. And one night we were having a pre-lecture meeting, and I was thinking about all the things that I had written down, written out, and what I was going to bring to the meeting. When I had a call from a young woman who asked me to visit her mother in the hospital. Her mother was not a student of Christian Science. She attended our church sometimes, but she'd had over the years about 10 operations on her heart. And she just, a few days before this, had another big operation. And the doctors had told her daughter that she wasn't going to pull through. And her daughter asked me if I would go and see her mother. She said she's unconscious, but it would bring me comfort to know that at least you were there and you were beside her. So I said that I would. And at that time I had a bed and breakfast, and I used to do evening meals. So I had to get two buses, and I stopped in town to buy all my groceries, and then I got another bus to go on to the hospital. I had about 5 bags of groceries. When I got to the hospital, this woman had never even left the operating theater. They said that she was too ill, and they had her on a life support machine. And the doctor said to me that it was just a matter of a couple of hours. The woman was unconscious. It was a very sad-looking picture. And I was sitting there beside her, and I was thinking to myself, well, what am I doing here? What is my role? I'm not here as a Christian Science practitioner. This woman has turned to medical for her help. And I thought, well, you know, even if she has, this woman has a right to some comfort. So I can just sit here and quietly know the truth. So I began to think about peace and some of the things I've been reading about peace. Like, I realized that the last thing that the Master left his disciples was peace. He had no worldly goods to leave anybody, had no property, no money, no antiques. And he left his most valuable possession, which was peace. Now, he must have realized that was his most valuable possession. So I began to think about that. He said, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." And then I knew that the peace of God that passeth all understanding was flooding her heart and mind, right where all this disturbance and pain and suffering and fear appeared to be. There was the peace of God. Well, my thoughts were just so full of this peace, I began to feel at peace. And the next thing, a nurse came up, and she got very excited, and she said, "Look, she's opened her eyes." The doctor came down. The woman had opened her eyes. He said, "Switch off that machine immediately." The woman became conscious, spoke to me for a few minutes, and then fell into a natural sleep. By this time, it was about 5 o'clock, and I had to get home, and I had to cook a meal for these men and then get out to church. So I decided that I could leave her. And when I got outside the hospital, everywhere was in darkness, and the security man on the gate said to me, "There's been a lot of bombs around town, and the buses have been taken off, and so you can't get a bus home. I'm sorry." Oh, I said, "I have to get home. I'm in a hurry. Is there anywhere I could get a taxi?" And he said, "A taxi? There's no taxis running, no buses running." And I said, "Well, there must be a taxi company near here." He said, "There's one over there, and that is on the Falls Road. And the Falls Road is IRA country, no-go area. There's no lights on. It's very dark. It's very scary." And I said, "Well, I have to get home, so I'd better go over there." So I went along to this little taxi office, and I went in. There were 5 drivers all sitting smoking. And these guys were all IRA supporters. And if you tell someone where you live in Belfast, they immediately know what you are. So I went in and said, "I would like a taxi, please." And they said, "Where to?" And I told them my road. And they all looked at me and they said, "Very funny. You know that we can't drive on that road." And I said, "Well, it's not that you can't, you just won't." He said, "Lady, whether we can't or we won't, get out, because we're not." So I lifted my 5 bags and I went outside the door, and I was calling the names under my breath and saying, "Well, how am I going to get home?" And the thought came, "Myrtle, claim your peace. Be at peace. You've been claiming it all day. Don't be disturbed." So I stood there and decided, yes, I'm going to be at peace.
The recording ends at this point. Thank you for listening.